Well, we got Dr. Drew with our COVID update, and Jordan Harbinger comes on. We talk about pyramid schemes, and there's a ton of stuff going on in the first half of the show, and lots of wisdom as well. So listen closely. First, I'll tell you about NetSuite, Oracle, NetSuite. Love these guys. America's ready to get back to work, but to win in the new economy, you need every advantage. Smart companies run on NetSuite by Oracle, the world's number one cloud business system. With NetSuite, you'll have visibility and control over financials, HR, inventory, e-commerce, and more, all in one place. Whether you're doing a million or hundreds of millions in sales, NetSuite lets you manage every penny, give you the agility to compete with anyone and work from anywhere, even from your phone. So you always have your business with you. Join the 20,000 plus companies who trust NetSuite. Right, Dawson?
NetSuite surveyed hundreds of business leaders and assembled a playbook of the top strategies they're using as America reopens for business. Receive your free guide, 7 actions businesses need to take now, and schedule your free product tour at netsuite.com/Adam. Get your free guide and schedule your free product tour now at netsuite.com/Adam. netsuite.com/Adam.
Hey, it's Adam Carolla. For those of you who caught my live stream stand-up recently, you know we partnered with Live by Live to make that show available, free of charge. And Live by Live has so much more to offer. Remember what MTV used to be? When M stood for music? That's what Live by Live is, but it's much better. The all-in-one music app provides live streaming concerts, thousands of streaming radio stations, expertly curated and in every genre of music, podcasts like The Adam Carolla Show, and tons of original music and entertainment content. Our friends at Live by Live offer to give fans of my podcast 2 months free of Live by Live Plus, which gets you no ads and unlimited audio skips. Just go to livexlive.com and search for Adam Carolla, or get the Live X Live app. That's livexlive.com, or download the Live X Live app to start listening to music and watching the very best concerts.
From Carolla One Studios in Glendale, California, this is the Adam Carolla Show. Adam's guest today, Judy Gold. With Gina Grad on news, Bald Brian on sound effects, Jordan Harbinger stops by, and Dave Damashek's here for good sports. And now, you can't see his tax returns, but you can get his stand-up comedy special, and you'll see his Social Security statement. Adam Carolla.
Yeah, get it on. Got to get it on. A choice, but to get on a mandate, you get it on, man. Thanks for tuning in, and thanks for telling a friend. Love that about you. Right, Gina Grad?
That's right.
Handball, Brian?
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that. That's Phil. All right. Yeah. All right. Let's see. I got stuff to talk about here. Made us a couple of reminders. I was talking to Dr. Drew the other day, and as I do sometimes when I take my dog for a walk, we just chat about life. And, you know, it's interesting. Dr. Drew's a curious guy, and always try to tell people to be curious, you know, and then there's so many people that aren't curious, but if you're not curious, you don't learn anything. And who are these people that are
those people seem to think they know the most?
The uncurious people.
Yeah, the uncurious and not interested in adding information to their repertoire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like Steckler used to say, there are two kinds of people in the world, slow learners and no learners.
Right. And so Drew, because Drew's Drew, I mean, he constantly saying, like, what's going on? Or what do you think about this? Or how about that? Like, he's floating these notions all the time. And if you spend enough time in front of guys like Drew or even guys like Mark Garagos. Now, I think the common, I guess, mistake a lot of people would make, and certainly the sitcom version of Mark Garagos, is a blustery, know-everything kind of attorney who you can't talk to because he knows everything. He's a know-it-all or whatever. But when and that is partially true. But when guys like that start asking questions, it means they've decided you have some answers. Because I think we've all done that version where, like, a Jehovah's Witness has showed up at our door and we're not like, wait, I got 1,000. You're like, okay, all right, here we go. I got to make an appointment, you know, just kind of pushing them out the door. But then you run into people with a lot of answers and a lot of notions and a lot of thoughts. And so they end up asking you a lot of questions. You ask them a lot of questions. I don't know if curious is a state and almost like happy is a state, satisfied, dissatisfied, patient. You know, my daughter has no patience. My son has tons of patience. What is that? How'd they get that way? Are you curious or you're not curious? How do you tell someone to be curious? How do you tell someone to be patient? How do you graft anything onto anyone that is a trait? You know what I mean?
Yeah. It has to be sparked somehow. It reminds me of literally within the last 3 days, Christy has been obsessed with Hamilton. She loves it. It's amazing, blah, blah, blah. But now she's like looking up like stuff about Thomas Jefferson and like looking up information about George Washington. Was George Washington really blah, blah, blah? She looks it up. It's like,
I did the same thing.
There's a spark.
Yeah.
Right. But some people don't have any kindling. All they have is wet beach towels. So the spark is the spark. Everyone sees Hamilton and sees a spark. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone sees Hamilton. They get the exact same information, right? I see Hamilton. You see Hamilton. Christy sees Hamilton. Everyone sees Hamilton. Hamilton is a spark. So and no one can deny the spark. Everything's a spark. You know, you hear about SpaceX has launched a rover. You know, that's a spark. You heard it. Well, you heard it the same way I heard it. Now we want to take a deep dive into finding out what's going on, or you just have the spark. So what you want is that kind of dried tinderbox, and then the spark turns into a raging fire of information. Many people, it's a hamper full of wet beach towels, and the spark just lands on it, and
it finds no purchase.
Right. That's how it works. It's funny because we get caught up in the spark, but it's not the spark because everyone experiences the spark. Everyone is interested in Hamilton and they enjoy it and they watch it multiple times. A certain percentage of people then will take these deep dives into the characters and educate themselves. And then they're the folks that are buying books and getting deeper and deeper and deeper into it. And then there are others that just watch it. They see that spark and then they move on to the next spark, which is the next piece of entertainment that comes down the pike. You know, and I realize that it's a wiring. I think we try to fool ourselves into thinking we can take that hamper of wet beach towels and turn it into whatever Tom Hanks was trying to get started on that island, blowing on it with the husk from the coconut. But if it's a fucking wet beach towel, it's a wet beach towel. We think we're going to, you know what our thing is? Like, we got to throw more sparks on it. You know, that's our thing. It's like, oh, okay, not interested in Hamilton, not sparked. How about this story or how about that story? And amazingly, you'll see the through line, which is no spark purchase. And that's the tough part. And that's the part of like, how do you bestow that or inculcate that on a child? And if the answer is you don't. I mean, it's kind of a math issue. I mean, we all went to high school with those people, right?
Yeah.
Not interested.
It's funny because Christy's interest in American history is now coming on at age, whatever, you know, 41. But, like, I have to imagine she was the same way in high school, your example. Like, this just happens to be the thing now, you know, the thing she's kind of into, the spark caught.
Well, that's the other thing, too, is you will get sparks from a lot of different directions and subjects, ideas, political, entertainment, you know, whatever. And you'll want to explore all those sparks and hopefully it's going to evolve. You know, it'll go from, you know, boy bands to, you know.
That's what it is in your teens. You know, I mean, it's frivolous shit, but it's still a curiosity.
Right. But I would bet you that Christy in her teens was exploring those other subjects that were sort of age appropriate, but with the same vigor or the same posture that she's now exploring this one. I'm also here to tell you, you can't swap out your hamper full of wet beach towels, but you can refine your fire starting. Like, you can learn techniques that help that. So I was a dried tinderbox looking for a spark, but I never knew how to get the spark to cause the fire. I couldn't cultivate it when I was young. I wanted the information. I didn't know how to get it. I didn't know what to do with it. Once I got it, I didn't know what it could be converted into. You know, it could be converted into comedy or sales or a dinner conversation.
Or you know, accumulated knowledge.
Right. I did not know how to do any of that. And that, I think that conversion process, that can be taught. All right. Didn't even mean to go down that road, but I was talking to Drew. I thought it was interesting as well. I was talking to Drew about, I said to him, you know, we need to get out there. We need to impose this stuff on our life. We need to hear the word no more often. I said to Drew, how many times did you hear the word no when you were a kid versus how many times did my kids hear the word no? I mean, I said the only reason I stopped hearing the word no is because I heard the word no so many times I stopped asking for things. So about
that's
11,
one way around it.
I never heard the word no again after 11 and a half because I realized I'd heard an unbroken streak of 18,000 no's that I wasn't going to spin the wheel again and just have it land on no. I just stopped asking and would just start leaving the house or buying whatever I wanted to buy or whatever it is. But and you start thinking a little bit about what's going on in our society and how people seem sort of unmoored and out of control. And I thought, people aren't hearing the word no. Like, just, hey, can't do that. Not going to happen.
Are you talking about kids or
everyone
in general?
I mean, growing up with parents, you know, the number one no-sayer in the house is usually dad, and dad's out of the house. The number two no-sayer is the mom. The mom's at work all day. The number three is the teachers, and we've decided they're not allowed to say no anymore. We get to say what we want. And now it then bled into the cops. I mean, when you see how people act in front of cops now, picture a version of yourself. Picture a 15-year-old version of yourself watching people screaming at cops and dumping buckets of water on their heads and jumping on top. You know, the cops are in the car and you're jumping up and down on the hood of the car.
Like, it wouldn't make sense.
It wouldn't compute.
Your 15-year-old version of yourself be like, what is going on? That person must have inhaled a barrel of bath salts. Like, and what are bath salts? I mean, the point is,
No, I agree with you, but it's funny because, like, not hearing no, you give the example of, you know, dad out of the house, mom at work. That's a very small slice of the population. What I think is happening is, we talked about this before, like, in order to give your child the best childhood you can, which is a noble effort, but you end up not saying no as much. You know what I mean? You know, giving in or getting them what they want, or Amazon will be here in 2 days. Sure, you can have that. That kind of thing. I think that's probably much more widespread.
Well, the families are broken and the dads are out of the house and the moms are working. Sure. But either way, the ones that are staying together aren't saying no very much either. I mean, my kids don't hear no very much and they sort of act accordingly. What happens when they get older, they get into the workplace and someone tries to tell them no? I mean,
they sit down in the middle of a Costco and then file a lawsuit.
Right.
Start throwing things out of the basket.
I mean, we literally just had a bunch of kids at the New York Times telling the editor, we didn't like that you ran this op-ed piece. You need to leave. Like,
but it's called an op-ed piece.
That's not our op.
Ed.
Right. So, but I mean, it's a little scary. And then I also started thinking about this notion of because Drew's like, what's going on out there? And I've told you guys a million times, we decided that the prime demo in this country was young people and young women especially. I used to say, remember I come back from the sports bar in Detroit and go, why are they pumping Rihanna in a sports bar at the airport in Detroit? Why 12 years ago, why are they pumping it at a steakhouse in Manhattan? Like, where is this coming from? And then I started really realizing that whenever you talk about television, it's always the demo. Mm-hmm. The demo is the most important. And the demo is like 18 to 24, 34 or something. It's like the young demo. That's what you want. You want the demo.
That's a sweet spot, peeps.
Right. And I'd always be like, I don't get it. When I was 26, I couldn't afford a Mercedes or almost any new car. Now I can. What do you mean? Why am I not the demo? I have tons more money than I had when I was I had three roommates and a Zuzu Trooper when I was 28. I couldn't afford fucking Top Ramen. I had to get the middle ramen.
I had no disposable income in my entire 20s.
Right. But it's like, but that's the demo. That's the demo. Yeah. That's the demo.
Isn't that the old Mad Men thing? Like you can duke it out with the adults who've already made their choices, or you can hook them young and brainwash them, and then you'll have a customer for life.
Yeah, and that's the adage, and that's how they think. So we took a society and we started steering it toward a young demo, deciding they had all the power. And I could remember talking about like how's Kimmel doing in the late night ratings versus Colbert, whoever. It's like, well, he doesn't have as many in the cumulative, like the overall, but in the demo, that's all they care about is the demo. It's like, they don't care if you have 5 million versus 2 million viewers. They care that you have 10 more in the demo. It's like, in the demo. I don't even know if they know, by the way, you know, the older you get, you realize that all the TV executives and all the radio executives and all the program directors, they didn't know jack shit about anything any of the time. Mm-hmm. I'm starting to think that the demo is going to be the same thing. But either way, once you realize you're in the demo, then you're in demand. I mean, now everyone's turning to 19-year-olds going, what do we do? What's next? What do you like? What do you want? What don't you want? And let's please not offend you. We'll get voted out of the cornfield by the prime demo. So that was my demo. I think that demo is going to demolish this society. Thank you.
Speaking of cornfield, just to bring it full circle, you know, everything you were saying about being curious, the cornfield is literally the thing that I couldn't stop laughing about while you were saying that, because when you were talking about that, I thought, well, but there's a dark side to curiosity, because when I was a kid or younger, a young teenager, my friends didn't like to go to movies with me because the big example of this I'll never forget is my best friend at the time. And I went to see Field of Dreams and I couldn't follow the movie. I couldn't focus on anything. And I kept whispering to her, and she'll still text me this every once in a while. She'll text me the words, but where did they go?
Right.
Right. Like, into the cornfield. Shh.
It's not a kid's movie.
Where did they go? And I can't, it's like, it's not enough that you're just telling me to suspend my disbelief. Where did they go? This movie goes no further until I know everything. So sometimes there's a dark side. You can't focus because you have to know everything.
Oh, I remember watching Smokey and the Bandit with my stepdad. And at a certain point, he just like, he didn't talk. My stepdad, John, doesn't talk. But at a certain point, he just like leaned over and he went, you have to shut up. Like, you have to stop asking what's going on, who that guy is, why, okay. Why can't.
That's Smokey, that's the Bandit.
Yeah. I had a lot of questions about Smokey and the Bandit. All right. I talked to Drew a little bit earlier this afternoon, and I asked him for our usual COVID update, because there's a lot going on out there now. So he weighed in, and I thought, well, we'll just run that, and then we'll come back. We'll talk to Jordan Harbinger right after this.
So the uptick that we discussed last week continues. And, you know, this virus has, because it's so-called R-naught, its infectivity is what's so surprising about it.
What's R-naught?
R-naught is just a symbol. It's just an infectious disease term for infectivity. Like how many people, if your one is the R-naught one, it's 1-to-1. Is it 1-to-2? Is it 1-to-3? How does it transmit? And its R-naught is pretty powerful, and that's one of the things about the virus that is so frightening. And if you notice that, so now we've had an uptick, and as I mentioned last time, it's, you know, now it's time to get it under control and to distance and wear masks and do these things that get it under control. But people have been resisting. And if you look at the graphs in some states, you'll see the rate of increase in the virus is not a steady slope. It's a slope whose line whose slope is increasing. So it becomes like a parabola, right?
Yeah.
And when it hits that phase, that's when things can kind of spiral.
Well, it's interesting. I don't know why, but it's not a – it's funny. I was talking to Travis Pastrana, the super motorcycle stunt guy, and he was explaining that Evel Knievel's ramps were wedge ramps. He'd be going flat. Then all of a sudden just wedge, like a doorstop.
Yeah.
And he said it was a horrible ramp because your suspension would bottom out as soon as you hit that thing.
Yeah,
and his was like, they realized progressive is how you do it. You know what I mean? Like work your way to that angle. But anyway, I don't know why his voice popped in my head.
Well, to be fair to that sort of Newtonian physical example, that's what gives you the maximum lift at the top.
Right.
Right? And that's the problem is that we're getting to that period where the lift is up.
Right. So it's not a wedge where it's just heading up. It's lifting up. Like it's not Evel Knievel's ramp.
That's
it's Travis Pastrana's ramp.
That's right. And so that's really concerning, right? And so it puts us at kind of an inflection point. Now, I've been thinking, I thought, you know, people are very critical of the federal government for not having an overall policy. I would only point at the fact that they're not modeling wearing masks, but that's up to them. But to have a nationwide policy makes zero sense to me. Zero. I mean, think how different it is in San Antonio versus Shreveport versus Ketchum, Idaho versus Los Angeles. These are – each local epidemiologies are completely different and they should be managed by their local county health officials with some input from the state, right? We agree. All agree on that.
Well, I was looking at the chart earlier today. I talked to you about this before. I was kind of almost flabbergasted, and I never get to that stage.
What? Slow down. The monocle fell out of your eye.
Yes.
Are you okay?
Into my highball. Because the comedy is the monocle
has to
fall out.
Has
to land in your drink.
Right. And it would usually be a martini because you have to have a big opening at the top.
And then you're. You have too much starch in your cummerbund chest, whatever, and it would roll up like a shade.
Nobody – he doesn't know what you're talking about. These two guys do not know what you're talking about.
When you would wear a – I guess when you would wear a tuxedo
– 100 years ago.
Instead of wearing a vest underneath, you would have a
– I think it was a kind of to go – something to give us a flat white appearance as opposed to your shirt so there'd be no wrinkles in it.
Right.
So essentially a cardboard
And I think a piece of elastic like went around your hips and attached to it. I don't know what that thing was called.
I've never seen one, but it was a routine trope on television and cartoons especially.
It was – people wore it when they wore spats.
Yes.
And then at a certain point, if they got really uptight or really angry, that thing would roll up like somebody pulled a blind and let it go. And it went that was the joke at the top. But what is that piece called?
Good luck.
They'll find it. Yeah. All right. So when I was looking and I saw, I guess it was New Jersey maybe.
Yeah.
I just look at death per 100,000.
Yeah.
New Jersey was at 173.
Yeah.
Texas was at 10.
Right.
That seems like a big
difference. Yeah. Jersey was a success.
Well, according to the news, it was a success. And Texas
tip our hat.
Texas was the problem. But it was New Jersey at like 173, New York at like 168. And by the time they got to Texas, it was 10. Look, Drew, to me, I'm kind of a bottom line kind of guy, which is, as we all know, I got into an epic argument with a guy a million years ago when I was pulling onto the Man Show lot where I put my car in reverse and he was walking behind. And his argument kept – and I stopped very quickly. Drew, over here.
I know.
And he sent
– I just texted with Adam, so shut up.
The point is this. My argument with this guy's argument was you almost hit me. And my argument was, but I didn't hit you. And his thing was, but you almost hit me. And I'm like, okay, but that's not hitting you. Mm-hmm. Like, that's my wiring.
Yes,
so it's like, deaths per 100,000.
That's the equalizing piece of data.
Right, because otherwise it's Montana and New York, and we can't figure out who's doing what. But are we right to focus on deaths per 100,000 citizens? Look, we could be talking about Spain or Italy.
Yeah.
I mean, just per 100,000.
I mean, local health officials, because they have to worry about resources, have to look at deaths overall, right? Actual numbers of deaths in their area. But death per 100,000 allows you to compare apples and oranges, you know. It turns everything to apples and apples.
Right. Okay. So did anyone know Texas was at 10 and New Jersey was at 173?
Let me push back on you a little bit.
Yes, I'm curious.
In that the issue that the infectious disease guys are focused on is not the number of deaths per 100,000, but the rate of increase of
now they're going
oh my God, New York, Italy, here it comes in Texas, right? How they think,
right? So now a lot more positive tests, and then you hear Trump say, well, of course we have more positive tests, we're testing more. And then you turn on CNN and they go, wow, that idiot, he doesn't even know what he's talking about. But then again, I'm caught in between again. I'm like, well, it seems like more testing would yield more positive tests, but what is wrong with that statement?
Let me give you a new wrinkle that you're not hearing on the press, and I'm hearing it from the front lines, which is that testing is – I'm going to describe this as temporally nefarious.
Mm.
That is to say, you could get COVID today and your test may not be positive till next week, or it may be positive today and negative next week, or turn positive and then go negative and then go positive. So there – and we don't know if that's the inaccuracy of the test, the testing procedures, or the way this virus is behaving. So this testing – so the idea now of a national testing protocol, to me, sounds like a horrible idea till we figure out what's going on with this virus, number one. Number two – Let's say it's magic and we found the perfect test and the perfect procedure and we could test everyone in the country today. That's just today. We're going to have to test you again in 3 days, 6 days, 9 days, 12 days, 15 days,
three months down the line.
And so employers are finding this, that doing the testing, unless you're the NBA and you have unlimited resources and really valuable products, then you're testing every day. But other employers are finding, like, why are we doing this? They get sick. Then we test them.
All right. So let me try to work this out.
Yeah.
The rate of infections are going way up.
Yeah.
The deaths are not going way up. There's more hospitalization because the rate of infection is going up, but the death rate isn't following along. Is it because younger people are testing positive?
Yes, and my profession is doing a much better job treating.
And there's that part too.
And let me tell you, probably what you'll start hearing about this week, what will start pouring in, really positive studies on hydroxychloroquine.
Oh, no. But that's a first-hand killer,
I know.
Drew.
It's going to kill more. But wait a minute. Hold on. I'm confused.
Yeah, right.
Some people are starting to – it's driving me a little nuts. They're going – boy, the test said good and then bad. And then how is this science? How is it science that studies show the same thing is both good and bad? Everybody, that is fucking how science works. There's many errors in the experiments. There's errors in the analysis. There's errors in the assumptions, which is why we have to reproduce studies over and over and over and over again till we can really start to reach a consensus about what the experimentation is telling us.
All right. So the strain of the virus is not getting less weak, or maybe it is.
Maybe more infectious and maybe weaker.
So it can actually it can mutate into more infectious and weaker simultaneously?
Correct. So more likely to get it, but less likely to get severe illness.
Right.
I'm not putting my money on that. But that is being discussed.
Society's opening. Young people are going out. Young people are getting infected.
But hold on. Lockdown is imminent.
You think so?
Garcetti announced it last night here in Los Angeles that all that little dial has to go from orange to red, and I'm locking you down. And I thought to myself, and no one's going to fucking listen to you.
Oh, that's right.
I thought impossible.
No, we're done. I you know, it's funny. I drove along the beach on 4th of July in right in the middle of Malibu. I mean, it's an interesting concept. I was in Malibu at the beginning of lockdown several months ago, driving up and down PCH, ghost town. Yeah. Nothing. Yeah. Nobody. And cops patrolling. Sheriffs all over the place. I drove out there on 4th of July. The no parking anytime cones were everywhere. Mm-hmm. Everyone was parked in between them. The whole coastline was packed.
Well, the sheriff said that they were not going to enforce the
sand. That's what happened. Yeah. All right.
And good for them. Is that really, that's what they want to do? Be handing out tickets to people?
It seems like my initial thought on this thing was always it was going to get spread far and wide. If you were healthy, you'd be fine, or you'd either be nothing or you'd weather the storm.
So I think that we are entering a decision point as a country. Well, at least certainly as California goes, and probably Arizona is in the same situation. A couple of states. See, New Jersey and New York it's run its course.
Mm-hmm.
They're nothing's going on.
What does that mean, run its course?
We don't know.
Why did it run its course in New York and not here?
We don't know yet. We really don't know.
Okay.
My bet is lots of vulnerable people, lots of concentrated elevators and living environment, no ventilation, and it came. So what was I? Oh, so here's the deal. I think we're going to be at the point where we tell our leaders to F off.
Mm-hmm.
In which case, this thing will be on.
Right.
And it will be on. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. It's going to be intense.
We're not going to. If there's another lockdown in L.A. or a lockdown in Arizona, the people are going to go, fuck it, we're going anyway.
What do you think?
Well, I was on. Here's what I think. You cannot humiliate and castrate and denigrate the law enforcement community and then snap your fucking fingers and tell them go enforce these laws. Stand down while people tear down statues. Stand down while people loot stores. Stand down while people light fires. But go enforce PCH.
Well, that was what the sheriff's department did on the beach.
See, how long
July.
Do they say to Garcetti and the city council? Fuck you.
Yeah.
So, yes, they're in no mood to – they didn't sign up to bust taxpayers. They wanted to go after perps. And the government said, leave the perps alone, go after the taxpayers. And they're saying, fuck you. So good luck.
Right. So that's the Riverside sheriff has said that and the LA County sheriff has said that.
Good. I'm with them.
So, but here's my concern. Here's where things I think are going to be a problem. I think we will be kidding ourselves about how bad this will get. This will get bad.
Which part?
The infection rate and the hospitalizations and the and once we commit, you can't then put the genie back in the bottle. You know
right.
what I'm saying? You got to be ready for what's coming.
Yes.
And it's not going to be pretty. Now, then people will self-quarantine voluntarily, right?
Right.
Because they'll want to the people that choose to do so will do
where,
so.
Whatever happened to herd immunity?
Well, that's how that will happen. Then we will be like Sweden at that point, right?
All right.
It may be. It'd take a long time to get to herd immunity.
All right. So that was fun and informative. Now we'll shift gears and talk about Jordan Harbinger's coming on the show, taking a deep dive into an interesting subject. Sponsored by NetSuite. Got a great segment going on today with businessman extraordinaire Jordan Harbinger. Jordan Harbinger.
Easy.
Harbinger. Harbinger. Brought to you by our friends at NetSuite. NetSuite, the world's – maybe it's the business that got me going. NetSuite is the world's number one cloud business system, trusted by more than 19,000 companies, and it's the last system you're ever going to need, right, Dawson?
NetSuite presents The Wonderful World of Business with Jordan Harbinger.
All right, Jordan we're going to talk about a subject that's interesting to me. What is that today?
So I did a deep dive on the type of people that are involved in these scams, like these multi-level marketing scams and these foreign currency trading things, these kind of get rich quick scams. That's what I wanted to focus on today, because I see a lot of people falling for this type of stuff, especially lately. There's more of it, and that could just be me noticing it more now, but I feel like I'm getting a lot more questions in the Jordan Harbinger Show inbox about, like, my friend is doing this, or like, hey Jordan, which one of these do you recommend, like this crappy protein shake scam or this crappy foreign currency exchange thing? And I'm like, slow your roll, man. You are in 11th grade, or you know, you're 24. You shouldn't be screwing around trading pesos for, like, I don't know, Chinese yuan.
Would Herbalife fall under this definition?
Yeah, Herbalife. I wasn't going to name check them because I was like, I don't know what your policy is on that, but they're like one of the biggest MLM, and I would say scammy MLMs around. I mean, all MLMs are scammy, but they're the name brand.
Well, you know, I can tell you, this is one of those things. It's sort of like when the government goes, we're going to raise the price of fuel to pay for the roads or whatever. Like, that really affects poor people. And these scams affect poor people. I've been sucked. When I was poor, I got sucked into three or four of these things. Somebody tells you the promise of making money, like, especially like you could have an extra $300 a week without even having to go to work. And you're like, oh, I need that so badly. Like, I need that stability. Like, I was, you know, part-time carpenter, part-time boxing coach, blah, blah. I was making no money. It's like, I could guarantee $1,000 a month if you, and I was like, oh, that would be such a life changer. And the next thing you know, you're sitting in someone's living room and then they're like, all right, I did. I bought when I was broke. I mean, when I was 19, and flat broke, I was sitting in someone's living room in Studio City in the Donnas, in the Hebrew Heights, in the hills. And I spent like $49 for a starter kit of Herbalife. And I didn't have $49. Like, and then it was nothing. I had this box, you know, with a bunch of shit in it that I never even knew what to do with. But yeah, it totally.
But that's the thing. That's the thing. Their job is done because you bought the box. What you do with it now is nobody's concern.
Everybody in that living room is desperate and poor. That's the part that gets stuck in my craw. Sorry, Jordan.
Yeah, no, you're not wrong at all. I mean, these companies deliberately target minority communities. They target immigrant communities. There's this whole. So I walked past the Herbalife convention outside of, I think, Staples Center. This is probably like 5 years ago now. And one thing I noticed was that there were thousands of people outside, but many of them have signs and banners, and they were all in Spanish. And I thought, oh, this must be just for like this very specific subgroup of Herbalife contractors or whatever they call themselves that are Hispanic. And I asked them, I said, oh, is this like a Spanish version of Herbalife? And they said, no, it's just Herbalife. Everyone hears from all over the world. And I was like, all over the world, huh? Okay. I don't hear any English. Everyone's wearing, you know, their flag. And it was like all Mexican immigrants. And I thought, this is really deliberate.
Where's the Norwegian contingency? I'm not seeing them.
Well, right. Those guys are out there selling the hot dogs wrapped with bacon.
Oh, right.
Yeah. I mean,
well, they got Antonio Villaraigosa, a.k.a. Tony Villar, they got him, the former mayor of Los Angeles, is now on their board or like working for them. So
that's ridiculous.
There you go. Wow. Right.
So Rolly was born to play.
Yes. They probably saw the value in this Hispanic guy who was, we did 8 years
at least,
or something.
At least two terms.
It felt longer. But anyway, yeah, they recognize that's why they're paying him to put his name on the masthead. Sorry.
They do that and they demolish these communities and they don't care at all. They really don't care. So the hope of the win, as you mentioned before, it's like gambling, except they tell you that it's a business, but it's not a business for you. If you are at the bottom, it's a business for the corporate folks and the guy who's getting paid $200K to be on the board and literally show up for like photos once a year to take a check. And we call it like, what is it called? It's like, when you sort of launder the reputation of something by putting somebody at the helm who's supposed to be respectable. These companies do this all the time. I know the non-PC term was like whitewashing something. I think, I don't know if we say that anymore, but anyway, it's laundering the reputation of this brand, and it's the hope of the win. It's like, you're going to be able to, like you said, an extra $300 a week, but first you got to call your family and you got to get your friends into it. And that's what destroys these communities of all types, because people who are poor and don't have any money to spend on this crap then have to rope in their sister and their auntie and their friends and their other other people that they know that also cannot afford to lose this money. They all go into this, and then suddenly everyone, or the people who are at the top, realize this isn't going to work. And by top, I mean like you recruit a bunch of your friends. Corporate types are fat cats. They recruit a bunch of their friends, and then suddenly everyone's losing money and they're going, hey, Adam, when am I going to get that extra $300 a week? Are you getting it? And now you got to make a choice. Do I tell them the truth and say, no, I'm $3,000 in the hole? Or do you lie and say, yeah, if you just keep on working, because that's who's paying you back for your $3,000 debt, is the people under you that you recruited. So now you've got to lie to your friends and your uncles and your aunties to keep them in the game so that you don't get even more screwed. And that just drags everyone down, and it decimates a lot of these people's bank books and their friend circles. So it's even worse than losing money.
You know, it's insidious, but when you're used to getting paid by the hour, so none of us have jobs anymore that are paid by the hour. You could take any job and extrapolate it to an hourly rate, but we're not paid by the hour, right? So when you get paid by the hour and you're getting $7 an hour, or $11 an hour, $13 an hour, the promise of getting paid while you're at home watching TV on vacation on a Sunday, that is so tantalizing, because I mean, I used to think about that all the time. It's always about punching in, clocking in. How many hours did you put in this week? Like, do you want to work Saturday? I don't, but I need the extra money, so I'm going to put a half day in. And then there's this promise of, oh, you're just at home and you're getting paid. And when you're getting paid by the hour, that dream of getting paid just because is so enticing. Seductive. It sucks you right into it, right?
Jordan, I imagine this is probably something you're going to touch on, so excuse me if I'm
scooping, good.
But I listen to a lot of podcasts about MLMs. I think it's fascinating. I stay far away from them, but I want to know everything.
Yeah.
And a lot of these, and please fill in the blanks here because I'm just throwing this out, but you're thinking, well, what the hell? Right when you start to think, what am I doing? What have I done? There's a convention and it's a party and it's a concert. And can you talk a little bit about the things they do to keep you excited?
Yeah, that's a great question. So they do have a lot of, like you said, the convention, like the one I walked past where people are jumping. I mean, this is like people are jumping up and down, holding the Mexican flag in this particular case. I mean, don't get me wrong. People of all walks of life fall for this. I'm just saying they target a lot of specific groups. They're jumping up and down. There's a lot of singing. There's a lot of chanting. There's face painting. I mean, it's very much a rah-rah cheerleader environment.
It feels religious. It feels like it's a religious revival kind of feel to it.
It's by design as well, because what they do is they offer these things to the people who sign up, and they say that they're free or that they're part of being a part of like whatever the makeup thing is or the Herbalife thing is, but they're not free. You pay. I looked into this because I was like, well, how are they making money if they're giving away these things? They have convention fees, depending on which one you're in. You have to pay this, which is essentially your ticket to this convention. And it might be like $350. And they're saying, no, this is just our cost to doing this. We're putting on an amazing show. And it's like, well, it's just your cost to rent the venue, hire the staff to run it, who are the ones who aren't volunteering, pay the Dr. Oz or whoever to like show up and shill for you, and all the other things. And you have to be like diamond super level or above, which means you're paying, you know, $3,000 a month in protein powder in your garage you're never going to use, plus your diamond fees or whatever it is. So you have to pay to go to these things. Then when you get there, it's you know, if you're not succeeding, it's because you're not trying hard enough. Look, here's Brian. He's been on stage before. Look at that beard he got from this hair growth stuff. It only works on your face. I don't know. And so, like, they just keep on telling you all these things over and over and over until you feel like, well, crap, it's not working for me. And no, the person next to you is not going to go, I'm broke as hell too, but I spent my last dime to get out here. They're going to go, yeah, I'm diamond level, just crushing life. You know, they're not going to say I roped in my whole family just to get here, hoping to learn some sales secrets from a guy in spandex, you know?
Sales secrets that never come.
Of course. Yeah, they don't come. There aren't any.
Can I ask Jordan a question I've always wondered? And since you did a deep dive, you probably know something about this.
Yeah.
So I don't want to pick on Herbalife. I don't know much about them, but the MLM, the multi-level marketing companies, what loophole allows them to escape Ponzi scheme laws, or what line divides them?
Great question. So a lot of people who are in these, they'll go, it's not a pyramid scheme. Pyramid schemes are illegal. In other words, this very circular argument, like if what we were doing was illegal, we wouldn't do it. And I'm like, tell that to the guy that sells me weed all the time. Well, before it was legal, right? Like, come on. So this is a circular argument. And the way they do this, what's funny about MLMs a lot of the time is, a pyramid scheme or a Ponzi scheme is, you say, hey, Jordan, send me $5, put your name on this list, then recruit 5 people. They'll send you $5. Look, you just made $20 after the 5 you gave me. And I go, great. That's what a pyramid scheme is, right? With people at the top. Mm-hmm. Well, what MLMs do, they are 100% a pyramid scheme in almost every instance, but they get around it by going, oh, no, you're not just sending me money. You're buying a product from me. And okay. I go, but I'm just keeping the product in my garage. I'm not distributing it. Nobody's going to buy it. Yeah. And you're telling me to just recruit other people. You're not telling me to sell the product. You're telling me to build my team. And they go, yeah, you can do whatever you want with the product, but we're selling you a product. Oh. Therefore, it's not a pyramid scheme. It's a loophole. Really, it is.
And if I'm not mistaken, I'm sorry, I just want to say, if I'm not mistaken, I believe people at the top of some of these companies, I can't remember which ones, specifically lobbied to make the law that way.
100%. Yeah, 100%. There's a lot of legal crap going on behind. They have so much money. It's insane.
I never really had a fundamental problem with a pyramid scheme if it was presented as a pyramid scheme, which is
like, you know what you're getting into.
Well, everyone's going to give $100. It's my idea, so I'll take $1,000. Jordan, you're next. Brian, you're after him. Now everyone's got to go out and recruit somebody to give $100. And if you do a good enough job, then you'll get to the top and you'll get your $1,000. Like, as if it's presented that way, in a way, I don't look at it that much different than going to Vegas and sitting down at the blackjack table. It's like, I got money. I'm going to take a chance here. I may not get it back. I understand how this works. Like, as long as it's presented as what it is, I think the problem with this stuff is it is a pyramid scheme. It's not presented
right
that way. Correct. Which is a big issue. Yes. Yeah, sorry, Gina. Yeah. We gotta bring
so
it home
about this topic. It was presented that way. It was a game called the Airplane Game.
Yes, the game.
Were you going to say that?
Yeah, I was going to bring
Florida.
That.
Yeah.
What was the Airplane Game?
It was the Airplane Game. Go ahead, Jordan. Sorry.
So they like, it's been a while, but the Airplane Game is, you literally go into this room with like folding chairs and they sit you down in a certain order and you have to pay like $5 to be on the airplane, but you're
like
literally
the pilot,
sitting in like
the flight attendant.
Yeah. You're sitting in like a formation like you would be on an airplane. And then like the pilot gets $10 and the flight attendants each get $5 and everyone else pays to be on there. And then you rotate, and it's the dumbest game of musical chairs in the world, but it's a pyramid scheme. And you're right, like these MLMs, over 99% of people lose money in MLMs. And these are self-reported statistics from companies like Herbalife that say that 99% lose money. So imagine if you're massaging it and you still come up with 99% are losing money, then it's even worse than that.
1% wins again.
1% wins again. Yeah, the 0.4% or whatever it is.
All right, Jordan, thank you very much. We got a little outro here.
What a wonderful world of business. Jordan Harbinger, brought to you by NetSuite.
Thanks, Jordan, for that deep dive. And you can schedule your free product tour right now. Just go get your free product guide. Go to 7 key strategies to grow your profits at netsuite.com/Adam. That's netsuite.com/Adam. And Jordan Harbinger. Let's see, what's your, where should I tell people to go, Jordan? I don't have your...
Send them to the Jordan Harbinger Show. They're already listening to podcasts.
Here oh, there they are. Jordan Harbinger Show. There you go. All Thank right. Comedian. Thanks, Jordan. Let's see. Judy Gold, comedian. You guys know her name.
Oh,
yeah. She's got book coming out that's very timely. And I'm excited to talk to her because it's called Yes, I Can Say That. When they come for the comedians, we're all in trouble. And I've said this. I've been a broken record on this shit, which is we're comedians. Comedians, you want to talk. You don't want to silence comedians. And so, right, once you get comedians to shut up, who think anyone who works for corporate America isn't going to zip it? Lickety-split. So we'll take a quick break. We'll come back with the comedian Judy Gold right after this.
For just $25, you get wine and gifts. Ace's favorite stuff or products from ACS. Every single month, you get the drink you choose. It's hard to beat cool stuff and booze. Adam's Monthly Nut. Adam's Monthly Nut.
Hey, Corolla fans, Mike Dawson here. I got some good news and some bad news. Bad news first, we're sold out of this month's Adam's Monthly Nut. Good news is you'll still be able to get all the incredible products from beerbong.com and Beard Bro after this month's Adam's Monthly Nut. Head to beerbong.com and get your 6-foot beer bong and a gold mine of other beer-related products. Believe us, you will get drunk and social distance if you need to. For all of you bearded men out there, remember to head to thebeardbro.com for all your facial hair needs. A big thank you to both Beard Bro and beerbong.com for participating in this month's nut. We'll see you soon for another shipment of Adam's Monthly Nut. The Adam Carolla Show presents Judy Gold's Birthday Cocktail Party for November 15th. Let's check out the guest list. It's the Macho Man, Randy Savage. Nickelback's Chad Kroeger. Be sure and get a photograph. Ed Asner is here. So is Beverly D'Angelo. From the Tonight Show band, Kevin Eubanks. And a representative of one of the separate but equally important groups, Sam Waterston. Now, back to the Adam Carolla Show.
Well, Jude, I don't want to get off to a rocky start, but that is not a great cocktail party. It's fine.
All right.
It's not
like, great. You know, Ed would be interesting. Ed, you know.
Ed has thoughts.
Yeah. After after hour four of him going, there wasn't one Jew in either one of those towers. Not one. Not one. Eventually, he'd have to move on to get the guy from Nickelback.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Not a good cocktail party.
Good
Shit.
To see you. It's been a long time.
Long.
I'm looking down here and realizing, yeah, we're up on stage together at the Comedy Central Bar Mitzvah Bash in 04.
Oh, wow.
So Comedy Central turned 13, I guess, in 04.
In 04.
And they had me host the show. And Judy, what did you do on that show? Did you co-host? Did you make an appearance?
No, I did stand up. I think I just did stand up.
And are you in New York now?
No, I'm in Provincetown, Massachusetts.
Is that you live there full time?
Well, I live in New York. I left on March 14th.
Oh, good.
I've had this house here since 94. It was I bought it when I got my first TV job on All American Girl with Margaret Cho. And through those years, those 26 years, I have been told by accountants and personal assistants, you have to sell your house. You have to sell your house. And I'm so fucking happy I never sold this house.
I know. Turns out experts don't know anything
they don't,
ever.
Right.
Like,
and you have to follow your gut. You have to,
I'm utterly with you, which is I had a conversation with a realtor who'd been working the area. It was in the Hollywood Hills. And I bought this house in like 1996. It was broken down and everything, but it was a great house under the Hollywood sign. It was like $350,000. And I put a bunch of money into it and I fixed it up. And at some point, maybe 2 or 3 years later, somebody offered to buy it for like $650,000. And this realtor had been working the area for 30 years said, oh, you should take the 650 for sure. And I said, why? And she said, well, it's not going to be worth $1 million one day. It's not a $1 million house. And I said, well, to be worth $1 million one day, it was worth $350 4 years ago. Now it's $650. She's like, but it's not going to be a $1 million house. It's 1.9 on. I did sell it, but not for 650, but 1 million, whatever. But it's 1.9 on Zillow now. Yeah, like she's what kind of expert is this?
Just want their commission. Everyone is short-sighted.
So true. All right. So the book, which I'm very interested in, it's going to be available July 28th on Amazon, which is
you can pre-order it
is what I'm saying. Yes, yeah. I can say that when they come for comedians, we're all in trouble. God, I've been screaming this from the top of every mountain for the last 10 years. How say you?
Well, you know, the way this whole thing came about is I did, you know, Vice TV, they were doing this segment on college bookers telling comedians, like these 22, 23 year old telling comedians what they can and cannot say on their stages.
Right.
And, I mean, no life experience, no knowledge of comedy. And I was interviewed as the opposing viewpoint. And I was like, don't you fucking tell me when I get on stage what I can say, what I can talk about. We are comedians. We are comedians. We are social commentators. We want to make our goal when we get on stage is to make people laugh. That's it. Don't tell me that you're triggered by a word. If you don't like a comic, then change the channel.
Right.
If you don't like their sense of humor. But, you know, there's so much that goes into a joke or a bit. Nuance, intent, context. Who the fuck are you to tell me, oh, I can't say that word, it might trigger this one. Or, you know, it's the progressive left that has really corrupted free speech.
Well, we've talked about all the time, which is it's not liberals, it's leftists. It's like progressive leftists. Liberal, I think most everyone you know is a liberal, sort of regardless of political affiliation.
Right.
They're liberal people. And the liberal, we used to just kind of have liberal and left, which is kind of in the same crock pot. Like, yeah, liberal, left, liberal. Like, they're the same person. And I'm like, I don't think they're the same people anymore.
Mm. Right. Not at all. Just like, you know, Trump doesn't represent the entire Republican Party. Mm. So this idea that comedians are being canceled, comedians are, you know, their life's work is being erased.
I'll tell you what strikes me as you're telling your story, but I've experienced it as well. The notion, and we do this thing, we did it early in the show. I said, imagine being 15 and watching people interact with cops on the news now. Like, you'd be totally confused. You'd be like, what is going on? What happened?
Right.
When I was 23 or 21 or 26, I could never imagine in a million years talking to a seasoned stand-up comedian, maybe a man or a woman in their 40s or 50s, and go, now look, here's some of the stuff you can say, and then here's some of the stuff you can't. I would have been like, who are you to talk to this person? You shouldn't even be talking to them. Why would they listen to you? Right. That guy's 45 years old. You're 22. What voice do you have? Why? There's this thing that these 22-year-olds are like fucking drunk with power. And they're like telling you, look, take this tweet down or modify this, or, all right, you're going to do comedy? Let me vet it. Do your set in front of me. I'll give you notes. Right. It's an unthinkable nowhere. I don't know if there was another time in American history or world history where 23-year-old or 19-year-old or 17-year-old know-nothing, numbnut, fucking snot-nosed piece of shit citizens thought they could talk to middle-aged people about how they needed to mind their P's and Q's. I'm giving you a little civics lecture, whatever it is. When I was a kid, I would never walked up to one of my friend's dads and trying to explain to him how he had to address me or I want to discuss your tone, Mr. Vending.
I can't say.
Right.
Yeah. Are you kidding?
It's the sense of entitlement and this idea. This is the other thing that gets me. The idea that being, first of all, I believe being offended is a choice. You make that choice, right? But I also believe that, you know, this idea that you can never feel uncomfortable, that, you know, like, what is this like? What are you being protected from? Like, oh, that triggers me. I get triggered. You're triggered for the fucking minute your alarm goes off in the morning. There are triggers. Learn how to fucking live, you idiots.
I
Sorry,
agree.
The world does not revolve around you.
And also... I know, I'm with you. Like I listen to these people talk and they're like, I feel unsafe. And it's like, I need to feel safe. And it's like, first off, safety isn't really a feeling, you know? And if you'd like to feel unsafe, look, anytime you fly in a commercial airliner, there's 200 people inside the 727, 737, whatever, Airbus. At any given time, 8 of them feel unsafe.
Right.
What shall we do? Turn the fucking plane around?
Yeah, no, we got to stop. They don't feel safe. Yeah.
Okay, I feel safe. You don't feel safe. You're 2 seats away. I don't give a fuck. Drink more. I don't know. What's our plan? So what do you want then? Well, I'd like the pilot to apologize. Like, okay, how does that make this fucking plane safer? Judy, you and I should do a show called Two Middle-Aged Assholes Scream About Shit All Fucking Day.
That's fine. I'm in. I'm so fucking aggravated about this shit. It's this, like, this idea, like, everyone gets a trophy. No! Not everyone gets a trophy because you suck at that. So you're not getting a trophy for sucking at something. Sorry.
Well, I'm looking down here, and I know you have a couple of kids. And I'm curious what you sound like in front of your kids. Oh, how old are your kids?
They're 20, 23 and 18. One's going to be 19. He's playing basketball for Tulane, my 18-year-old.
Really?
Division I.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I gave birth to a Division I athlete.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Well, and then...
I'm sorry, but people don't... You're 6'1", 6'2". I mean, you're very tall. You're very tall.
He's 6'8".
Wow.
But he's like a really great, great athlete. And I, of course, tried out for the basketball team in 7th grade. And the coach, Wayne Carrick, told me I was too tall for the team and it wouldn't be fair to the other players.
What?
I swear to God.
I
swear to God. So I ended up not playing basketball. I was a fucking band nerd, marching band, choir, you know, just... And now I see... It's just interesting to have a boy who's athletic and really tall and to see his experience in life versus I was 6 feet at 13 and my experience, you know, and the people would come up to me like with him when I'm with him. Oh my God, he's so tall. Thank God he's a boy. I'm like, I'm fucking standing right here, you asshole, you know?
I know what it's like because I didn't get the speech like your basketball coach did, but I did have a club owner once tell me they couldn't let me do stand-up because I was too funny. I made that
fuck
up.
Does that mean?
I just made it up.
I'd like to
explore this subject with you. I haven't gotten into it for a while, but I have spoken in the past about when, you know, everyone knows how tough junior high and high school can be, and especially for a girl or especially for the guy with the bad skin or the guy, whatever that thing is, everyone's so vulnerable and the hormones and everything. And everyone has always talked about, oh, the poor fat girl from junior high. But I've said, you know what? Worse than that, there were a couple of giant girls. Like there was a couple of huge girls, few and far between, but you knew who they were. They were just big.
Right.
You know what I mean?
That defines you.
Right.
It was hell. It was fucking hell.
Right. And the thing about the fat chicks is people didn't want to take them to the prom, but they wouldn't openly kind of make fun of them or talk about them because, like, okay, it's not fair. It's cruel or whatever. Right. The big girls, they kind of make jokes about because there didn't seem to be any stigma there, I guess.
Yeah, well, it was constant Bigfoot, Sasquatch, Orca. It was, you know, and so shut the fuck up. You would have totally made fun of me. That's why you're such an asshole.
Talk about triggering, Adam. Don't laugh. Wow.
You're trying to stifle free speech now.
I had to listen to.
I know, but I didn't get laid either, and I was miserable as well. So
right,
maybe
that's why you were making fun of, you know, us.
That's right.
But it was always like, you know, my mother used to say that they're jealous. That's why. And I'm like, they're not fucking jealous. Like, she would say the guys were jealous because they wanted to be tall. But it's like, it doesn't fucking matter. Like, I was taller than my teachers.
Oh, yeah.
My parents. But I couldn't wear clothes. Like, it was just fucking, and it defines you. It's like all you are is tall. But I had a lot more to offer.
Well, thank God you've put it in your rearview mirror and you never think about it anymore. You've turned the page.
Oh, never. Yeah.
No, but were you, I mean, I've been with you in person. You're not overweight person. You're a large person for a woman, especially.
Right.
Were you just a big individual? Like, that was just kind of big bone and tall and everything.
I was really, yeah. I was a large person, and I was really unpopular. So it's not like I could go be, you know, hide in the corner. It was like I really had nothing. I mean, I had my nerdy music and my nerdy music friends, but I couldn't wait to get the fuck out of suburban New Jersey. You know, I was lucky. My parents were older when they had me, but my mother grew up in Manhattan. So I had this idea that there's another world. Like, my parents were like, this is not the real world. You know, this is a suburb. You know, I grew up 27 miles from Manhattan, and there were people in my town who'd be, oh, I would never go to the city. Like, it's like, you have the fucking biggest city in the world, like 27. I don't go. Oh, I would never do that. It's like, just this idea that you could be so close and just, you know, isolate yourself so much. And there was that, they do that in their mind too.
My parents had the same relationship with Disneyland, which is, it's 27 miles from our house and we could never, never, no, they're pirates there. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
You want to get shot with a musket ball?
Right.
Use your head. So you're a big, I really want to drill down on this miserable childhood. Yeah. And junior high. Well, look, obviously you got a great sense of humor out of it. Or did you? Would you have had this sense of humor?
Oh, no.
Anyway?
I was always funny. And then in my family, you know, look, we all have our family Michigas bullshit. But, you know, in my family, being funny or a clever retort or something, you know, really snide and hilarious got way more attention. They didn't hug me. They weren't like lovey-dovey. But if you said something really funny or clever.
Well, maybe they didn't have a stepladder on them.
Shut the fuck up.
Oh, nice.
And they were all tall, so shut the
up. Math doesn't work. Oh, but if you're adopted by Asians, that'd be funny.
Yeah, right.
That'd be a sitcom.
Look, I got on. I was on my first show, All American Girl. I was like,
oh,
why
my God.
I played Margaret's best friend. Like, I was like, I'm 6'3". I was 6'3". I shrunk because I had a knee replacement. But I'm like, who?
What were your dimensions in high school? Like, when you were in the 11th grade, what were your dimensions?
Okay, are you trying to torture me? Like, is this?
No, I'm not. I'm just.
My dimensions. I don't know.
She never would have come on today had she known.
Oh my God, my dimensions. I guess I was probably like 6'2". I don't know how much I weighed. Probably like, you know, 175.
You're in the marching band.
I was in the marching band. I was gigantic.
Oh my God. Yeah. It's like, oh, we need an activity that involves a 3 foot high fur hat to put on Judy.
Yeah, exactly. So that was great too.
She's got a duck walking under overpasses.
Yeah. It was fun.
What did you play in the marching band?
It doesn't really get worse than this, and I'm going to kill you. But I played the clarinet.
Oh, yeah.
Now, you know, there's some instruments where you look cool playing it, like, you know,
yeah,
the trombone or the or the drum percussion or the, you know, the femmies with their little flutes, you know. Nothing is worse than the, you know, this fucking clarinet. Yeah, it's bad. It was bad. Yeah. That is one of the nerdiest sections of the orchestra.
So so when you got out of, when did you, I don't want to turn this into a grill session. And I'm apologizing. I'm only saying it because you have a sense of humor. I know you do.
Yeah, but I've been through a lot of therapy.
I do. I've very uniquely, and I've spoke about it on the show before, always just sort of thought about the big girls in the class. And I've always had always had thoughts about that, where I don't think other people did.
You know, here's the thing. You might want to explore that obsession. But the thing is that you know, you're a girl and you're going through girl things, but people react to you differently. They think you're not as sensitive. They think you're not as feminine. They, you know, you are sort of androgynized. And, you know, you're objectified in a completely different way. And this, you know, like it's really, and you know, what's interesting is I am a lesbian, but it's short men always are attracted to tall women. It's like they appreciate it. And tall men, you know, some of them, you know, like, but most of them like little, you know, they can pick them up, you know.
Right. Yeah. No, it's interesting because Nate at the other shop who I make the documentaries with is a short guy who was explaining to me the obsession that short guys have with tall women. He wanted to make a movie about it. And I was like, what are you talking about? I didn't really know what that was.
I love that. Yeah. They always, it's, and men of color like big women.
Oh, really? Well, I got a theory about that. I got a theory.
What's the theory? I can't wait. Go.
Well, I'll just put it on myself. I don't have enough penis to handle a Kardashian. There's just,
I got you.
It's there's not enough there for that. You know what I mean?
It's like Monstro and Pinocchio.
Yeah, I've always thought of it as like
like timely reference.
Like pulling a minivan into an airplane hangar. You know what I mean? Just there's too much. I don't need that kind of height. You know, and that kind of width, you know, I just not
but
enough.
Why do you think you were obsessed with big women? And it doesn't seem like it was a positive obsession.
No, Adam, tell her about when you carried that girl.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Oh, I forgot. Yeah, Mr. Bernal came in here, my psychology teacher or history. I can't remember Mr. Bernal, but he remembered a story. There was a very large woman, and her name was Debbie. And she was definitely, you know, 6 foot plus and, you know, 185 pounds. She was just the big girl. I don't know, the 11th grade or maybe senior year. And I think she tried to gussy herself up as Mr. Bernal, who came in here all these years later to tell the story. I'd forgotten about it. But I think she wanted to put on a skirt and like some high heels or something. She probably felt weird about wearing heels because she was 6 foot one. But I thought at some point she was like, I want to wear heels instead of flip-flops everywhere. And she put the heels on. And I guess she wasn't used to walking around in heels. And she like rolled her ankle and hit the floor and everyone was laughing and pointing and laughing and pointing. And it was all the usual stuff you'd expect. The big gargantuan woman tried to put the heels on, didn't know how to walk in the heels, fell over on the ground. And Mr. Bernal, as he told the story, I guess, or Gina, you tell it because I don't want to. I don't embellish it on my behalf.
I was going to say, I can't believe you don't remember this, but he said, Adam.
I do
just,
now, but sorry.
He got up. He wasn't laughing. He wasn't pointing. He wasn't being, you know, the general assholery of right. everybody else. He went. He picked her up and carried her all the way from one building to another to the nurse's office.
Oh.
Just to be a nice guy and not be a dick like everybody else.
Yeah.
That, oh, I love you for that.
Oh, well, I was super strong in playing football, and Mr. Bernal was like telling her to get up, and she was just crying, saying her ankle was rolled and the ankle was hurting. She couldn't move, and everyone's just sort of looking at her. And I guess I thought, well, she's not going to get up, and I may be one of the only people in this class who could pick her up. So that I did. And
I love you for that because, yeah. You know, there's nothing. It's like when we fall hard. And I never wore heels because I can't walk in them either. But I did have, I still have this pair of boots I have that are about, I guess, 3.5-4 inches. Ooh. And I would go to these like events, premieres and stuff, and I would be like 6'6", and I fucking loved it. But it took me so long to feel comfortable like that. I know this is something I shouldn't be telling you because I don't know what you're going to do with it, but I did not walk by a schoolyard until I was in my 30s because I thought they were just going to. Until I had kids, I couldn't look at his face. Look at his face.
Wow. I don't want to.
I think we can all.
Wait, no. I get it. Kids are fucking cruel. Well, kids will tell you who you are. Like adults will tell you who you are if you cut them off in traffic.
Right.
And they'll yell fat ass or bald head or triple chin or like whatever the fuck whatever you are, just that'll go. That's what they lead with.
Yeah.
So if you walk past a group of 11-year-olds and you're 6'3", you're going to hear something.
Yeah. And I just was like, I had enough of it. But it does define you when you're a woman.
Oh, yeah.
It defines you. And it's like so that's why I feel like, you know, part of me, I had a good sense of humor, but also getting on stage, I did my first set at 19 and I was controlling the laughter, you know?
Mm-hmm. That's a very interesting perspective. So for you, did you go to college right after high school?
I went to Rutgers. Yes.
I went to Rutgers. And then was it always, you got up at 19, so you're in your, I don't know, sophomore year, and you're thinking about, oh, I'm going to do this full time, or there's still thoughts about I'm a chemistry major, or whatever
oh, no,
you're studying
was,
in Rutgers.
Just to bring it home, I was a music major.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I did get on stage. I did have sort of an epiphany of I had never felt like, I mean, your first laugh, there is nothing that compares. And I always wanted to be a performer, but I would never get cast in the school plays because I was too tall. And it was always, you're too tall. And I did this and it was like, it was like God had spoken to me. If there's a God, who the fuck knows? But it made me realize what I wanted to do with my life. I did end up getting a degree, but I did do stand up through, you know, in college, and then when I got out, I you know, that's what I did. I have no job skills.
Did you I'm looking down here, Rosie O'Donnell show 98 and 99. Now Rosie kind of turned out to be this version of Rosie. There was another version of Rosie from 98, 99 with the Cutie Patootie Chub Club and everything.
Yes.
How much, and I think I know a guy, I think Daniel Kellison worked for her as well. He used to explain to me that Rosie isn't exactly the right name for Rosie's, for Rosie. But did you experience that back
then?
You
know, I knew Rosie for years, since the mid-80s. And so I knew her before this whole thing. And she asked me to write for the show after Henry, my first son, was born. And I have to say, I worked on that show for 2 years, and I was the human interest producer and a writer. And I had a really good time, you know? I feel like, look, she's not perfect, but she's not a bad person, you know? She's not a cunt. She's not like, it's this double standard with men being tough and know what they want versus women being tough and knowing what they want. You know, it's one is a bitch and one is, you know,
a leader,
powerful, you know, we equate power with masculinity, but.
But what I'm saying is, do you feel like she was trying to be something she wasn't for somebody? Like,
no, I think there that was a big part of her. This fangirl, I think she really, like, this was a dream come true for her. Like, that, you know, when you're a little kid and you think, oh my God, I want this, I want my own show. And she got her own show. And I do think there was a part of her that was this, oh my God, I can't believe you're on my show. And then I think that the business also, you know, it hardens you. It makes you realize that everyone's a fucking asshole, liar, you know, this business. So, but I do think that was a big part of her personality. And then after Columbine, she really changed.
Are you in touch with her? Do you?
Yes.
Correspond? And what's going on? My thing is, I like Rosie. I don't know her well. She seems tortured a little bit to me.
Oh yeah, absolutely. She didn't have it easy growing up. And you know, I really think you got to, when you're sitting at home with your kids watching a presidential debate and someone says, I only called Rosie a fat pig in front of her kids, like that you can't even, I mean, it does something to you.
And do you, I agree. Well, I mean, you know, it's kind of what we started talking about, which is, you know, microaggressions and then aggressions and what's said and what can't be said.
But,
and,
right.
And I agree.
Right.
No, look, if a comedian gets on stage and makes jokes and you find that threatening, something's wrong. If a presidential candidate gets on stage and says you're a bitch or fat or whatever it is, feel free to be hurt by that or feel damaged by that.
Right. But it's also, why is that even in the discourse? Like, why is that being discussed? Like you look at all these comics who people are bringing up shit from 15, 20 years ago. Like I just got into it about Kevin Hart. You know, Kevin Hart had a homophobic joke. I don't even think it was fun, but he's not homophobic. And I know Kevin Hart. And, you know, as a gay, as a member of the gays, you know, our goal is for people to evolve, right?
Right.
So once they evolve, why do you have to bring up, you know, shit from 15? Yes, we know that's what he said 15 years ago, but he wouldn't say that now. Why do we have to punish? But, you know, I believe everyone has the right to say I will fight for everyone's freedom of speech, even if it's like horrible, whatever. But a comedian should not be held to a higher standard than the president of the United States.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, this notion of like, we need to control everything all the time is a really bad notion. You don't need to control. Somebody could write a book you disagree with. Someone could have a cable show you disagree with. Someone could participate in a religion you disagree with. You just disagree. I don't like country music. I don't need to control those who listen to country music. Yes.
Right.
And we're living in a day and age where you can take to the internet and social media and express your displeasure or disagreement, or you have a forum now, like where you're years ago that wasn't the case.
Yeah, it's like everyone has a soapbox. And what? It's like they don't all deserve it.
Well, also, I think Dawson may be able to find it, but I just wrote a book, and when I was researching this little chapter about what you can say on campus and what you can't say on campus, I looked up like the activities board of UC Berkeley and all the events that were going on in like the month of May, and their whole shitload of events I wasn't interested in. You know?
Right, of course.
But I'm not going to try to get them canceled. I'm just not going to attend. You know what
right.
I mean? So you can have a meeting. And I mean, there was just a bunch of comical stuff you would have no interest in attending, or at least I would have no interest in attending. I would never in a 2,000 years try to get the meeting canceled or the speaker canceled. I just wouldn't attend.
Right. Exactly. It's called freedom. Freedom.
Right. That's right. All right. We'll try to find that. This book, by the way, yes, I can say that. When they come for the comedians, I agree. We're all in trouble.
Because you know what? We are the truth. We are truth tellers. We tell the truth. We talk about the things that make people uncomfortable. And also, comedy is so disarming. You know, if you make someone laugh, they automatically like you, right?
Right.
And it's a powerful medium because you can change someone's mind. I mean, think of all these comics that we started with. Like, there's comics with cerebral palsy, and there's little people. Like, they get on stage and they change people's minds. They educate. It's an there's so much, and we're so important. And when you start shutting down comics, then we really have no free speech. None. Zero.
No, you're exactly right. I'm thinking about someone like Brad Williams, you know.
Right.
He gets up there.
Yes, I spoke to him for the book. Yeah.
He starts talking about what it's like being him and growing up with him, and immediately it's disarming and it's relatable, and then you realize that maybe you don't have that problem or that situation that he has, but you have analogous situations. I mean, look at you and Brad Williams. So you're tallest person in the world. He's the shortest person in the world. But you probably had the same experience.
Right.
Many of the same experiences in high school, right?
Right. And then next time you see someone who looks like Brad or looks like me, you might say, oh, you know, even look, I remember in, you know, when people were coming out on stage and it was like it was the middle of the AIDS crisis. There were so many comics that were coming that would come out. Not a lot, but, you know. Enough and talking about their experience, like Steve Moore. Do you remember Steve Moore?
I don't remember Steve Moore.
At the Comedy Store. Steve Moore, Bob Smith was he was the first gay person, gay male on the Tonight Show.
Oh, the Tonight Show, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, the way he came out on stage he said, you know, I made my carefully worded announcement. At Thanksgiving, I asked my mother if she could pass the gravy to a homosexual. She passed it to my father. Okay. So, but, you know, what a non-threatening way to just come out on stage. There's Steve Moore.
Steve Moore
was, you know, he was HIV positive and he was getting on stage in the mid-90s saying, all right, if you don't laugh, I'm going to cut a vein open and spray it all over you. I mean, like, he was talking about things in a funny way and people were like getting educated. It's don't shut us down.
Is Steve Moore not with us anymore?
Steve Moore is not with us. Bob Smith died. He was my best friend. He died of ALS. I mean, but you know,
but here's my point. You're talking about him and doing his material. And if he was either not saying anything or doing knock knock jokes that whoever vetted it said it was safe to do, then you'd have no memory of it all these years later. You wouldn't be talking about it on this program.
Right.
I think we have the clip, so says Dawson, from the audiobook.
I love Dawson.
There it is. I know. Here are a few events that took place at the University of California, Berkeley in 2018. I had my staff pull for the podcast. These are events I would never go to. Solidarity for Nicaragua. Caravan for Peace. Mother, Daughter, Sister. Film screening and panel on sexual violence in Myanmar. Teaching about dialect. Identity, variation, and power. identifying and addressing workplace bullying. Actually, regarding that last one, I'd like to not only attend, but preside. I flick the lights on and off once and say, you're all worthless and weak. Now get the fuck out of here, pussies.
Well, thanks, Dawson. Good job. Yeah. Well,
I love that.
It's a bunch of stuff on campus that I wouldn't be interested in. But
Who the fuck would... Guys?
But who in a million years would storm into that meeting and demand that they be canceled?
Right. Exactly. You know, I was at the Cellar pre-pandemic, and Dave Attell says to me, do you think I could get away with doing this joke on my special? Now, I don't remember the joke. It was a Lezzy joke. And I was like thinking to myself, Dave Attell is worried about like getting in trouble. Like, this is a problem. This is a fucking problem.
Right.
Dave Attell, one of the funniest guys ever and fearless, is worried about repercussions of a, like, it's, it's so enraging.
No, I agree. And the part that scares me, it's never the nut jobs that are sort of the tip of the spear. It's all the people that kind of go along with it.
Yeah. Right.
You know, and that's people going, well, just don't do it. I mean, why would you even, you know, like those people.
Yeah. Why do that? You know, I get a lot of that with, you know, people like, well, it's easy. It's easier for me to not have a gender, just to abide by that. But you know what? But if I want to say it, does, I'm not going to. No, sorry.
No, I completely agree. And the problem with trying to work this new world order with comedians inherently have to be really specific. You know, you can't go, I know this guy, he's a douchebag. You have to say, right. I have to say a name. You know what I mean? And you have to declare a lot of majors, and you have to be really specific. And it never works if you're nice. I've always said this. I said, you know, there's an inherent problem in that you're on stage, you have a microphone, sometimes people are filming you, and somebody says, Adam, what do you think about your mother-in-law? And I go, Eunice, she's a delight. Next question. Well, there's no fucking laughs then. There's no laughs in saying something complimentary about a politician or your mother-in-law or your wife or your sister or whatever. You don't realize that in order to be funny, you have to be specific and you have to you have to have a little edge. Like, it's not about being nice. Yeah, it's about being honest. Right. All right. You're going to stick around to the news with us, Judy?
Oh, my God. I'm so excited.
All right. Let me just hit Geico here for a quick 30 seconds. They're offering an extra 15% credit on car, motorcycle, and RV policies. That's 15% off the top. On top of what you're already saving if you're going with Geico. So what are you waiting for, man? You want to save that 15% and get the savings that you already get when you go with Geico? Never been a better time to switch to Geico. Save the extra 15 when you switch by October 7th. Visit geico.com to learn more. All right, quick break. Back with Judy Gold in the news right after this.